Hello.
Hey, Bobby, it's Andy. How are you, man?
Hey, Andy, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm not too bad. Just waking up and getting ready for work while I interview you.
Okay. Prepared to do this.
Yeah, I'm good. So it's the 50th anniversary coming up. How does it feel to be a singer in a band that you formed 50 years ago and still be around? Is it crazy, or?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. I didn't think I'd be alive, to be honest.
Not a lot from your era did.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Are the crowds still as energetic, or are they more so now?
We haven't gone to Europe again yet in a few years, but, you know, the crowds here are good, too. I mean, they've gotten younger, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, you're being interviewed by someone who's 28 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like turned over another generation, really, again. It's like been kind of, you know, almost three of them.
It seems like the scene that you helped create it has been, like, getting a little bit bigger and bigger, even though it's still hugely an underground thing.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever, like, go, you know, over the top.
There's no way it could possibly
do
that, because there's no mainstream capability to any of the bands, really.
Right, and also, nowadays, especially records, well, they're starting to again, but records don't sell.
Yeah, they don't. Albums don't sell like they used to.
Not near. I mean, you know, it used to be a group selling, you know, a few hundred thousand units. Now, or they're lucky to sell, you know, 30.
Yeah, that's the thing. It seems like people have cheapened what music really is, and it's making a lot of cheap music come from the record companies.
Well, it's not really as much, I don't think, the record companies as the availability of the streaming. You know, I mean, YouTube and Pandora, you know, Spotify. I mean, you can, well, on YouTube especially, you can get music for nothing, you know?
Yeah, that's the sad
thing. And you can see anything. I mean, my God, I look on YouTube sometimes, and I'll remember a TV show from the late 50s, and it's there.
Yeah, I watched All in the Family on YouTube already.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty bizarre.
It's got its ups and it's got its downs, because with
right.
making everything so readily available, people have so many choices, they don't even sit down and listen to a full record anymore.
Right, that's the thing. People, for a while, it was really, and I guess still, is just fashionable for people to download one song if they don't, if they like it, and you know, that's cool too. But I mean, from what I gather, people are starting to get into, you know, listening to vinyl a lot more again.
Vinyl sales
topped
a lot of download and CD sales a couple years ago. I don't know what that has to say for the future, but. Obviously, people are wanting to go back a little bit to simpler ways, and they have modern technology to make those ways easier, too.
Right. They have better listening, you know, devices for equipment and stuff like that. But I think a lot of it is the fact that I was reading an article recently, and younger people are getting tired of the fact that there's nothing tangible to hold. Like, you know, the download song, you don't have anything, you just have the sound.
Yeah.
It used to be so much fun to sit with an album cover in your hand for hours on end looking at it while you listened over and over.
Yeah, I've always said that I was born in the wrong generation, because when I was 14, and that wasn't that long ago, mind you, I had a record player setup that was strictly from the 70s with the realistic turntable, the realistic receiver. I had an 8-track player. I had a CD recorder so I could put 8-track or CD or cassette directly onto CD. Like, I literally had fun. So much of my youth was spent learning how to play guitar and staring at album covers and looking at the sleeves and the liner notes. And it was so cool to go record shopping because it was all used. You'd go into a record shop and not know what you were going to find and come out with an armful of albums, like 10 of them, for like $7.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you at least had some, as George Carlin would say, some stuff. Yeah. You had some baggage with you when you left.
You had something to show for your purchase, not just, oh, hey, I can hear this.
Yeah, exactly. And that's becoming more and more popular, you know, from what I gather, again, that people are getting sick of, you know, not having anything to collect as such.
Yeah.
You know?
It was only a matter of time before that started happening, and the only way it would stop is it went back on its own.
Right.
I think, because some people are too demanding. Do you ever find, if you do something that a majority of your fans don't really like, that, like, they become kind of entitled, so to speak?
Well, I think that can happen. You know, but as far as I'm concerned, the fans, the Pentagram fans out there to this point are really pretty damn thankful. I get a lot of, you know, nice comments and thankful comments, you know.
And you know, I'm very thankful for everything you've done as well.
Yeah, it's really cool. It gives a lot of gratification, you know, and a lot of warmth, you know.
Well, that question came from, I was interviewing Phil Lewis from LA Guns a couple months ago, and he said that they've been catching a lot of hate because they kind of got to a point where they don't want to do festivals like the M3 Fest or those big hair metal festivals that come around every summer. They get paid the same amount to play a gig in a smaller venue where they headline the show. They don't see a point in restricting their set to 45 minutes just to appease a bunch of boomers.
Well, nah, I don't look at it like that. See, I love playing big festivals.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. And when we play in Europe, there we play a lot of huge festivals, you know. And there's tens of thousands
of people. Are a lot different than
that's really neat.
Yeah.
I mean, I of course, in the States, you know, we play virtually no festivals, you know, once in a while, but of course, you know, it has its ups and its downs. You get cozier with a small crowd on the other hand, you know.
Yeah. That's the one thing about this scene that I've always admired, is that you and a couple other people as standing pillars in the genres are complete and utter respected legends to a degree, but nobody outside of the inner circle really knows who the hell you are. When I show people your music who have never heard of it before, they're blown away. Even people who aren't quote-unquote metalheads.
Well, I'm glad. You know, I mean, I've tried to keep it a bit on the different sounding side. You know,
ever since we talked and you said you were into Blue Oyster Cult and Kiss, I can hear that in your music, and I can't unhear it. And it's not a bad thing.
Right.
I mean...
Oh, yeah, I think, you know, I love the first three Blue Oyster Cult albums. They're classic albums.
Oh, yeah, the self-titled up through Secret Treaties. Secret
right.
Treaties is probably the apex, in my opinion. Flaming Telepaths, that song just touches my soul, man.
That's really strange, because that's my favorite Blue Oyster Cult song, and that's my favorite Blue Oyster Cult album.
My favorite used to be Astronomy, until I started listening to the album the whole way through, and I'm like, Flaming Telepaths is just a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the vibe. It sends chills, man.
Yeah, because as well, it's got that downer thing to it, too.
Well, so does Astronomy, but it's just the vibes are the same, but there's something about that chorus that just drives me nuts on that song, you know?
Yeah. Right.
It's like John Lennon and Paul McCartney's vocal melodies seem so good it should be criminal.
Oh, my God. Well, there's, you know, that's an unequatable thing you're saying right there. I mean, you know, Lennon and McCartney together,
to
oh, my
records,
God,
man.
It's always going to ring superior.
Yeah, I mean, you listen to the early records, and yeah, the music's bubblegum, but if you listen to John and Paul's voices together, it's harmonious, and they didn't
the blend,
have any
the blend is sound together. It's just...
It's like the white English version of Motown in a way. It really is. I've always said that because it's just, there's no other way to put it.
Yeah, they've got harmonious superiority.
And they'll never be topped or haven't since. And even with all this technology, you can't really do what they did.
Oh no, you can't get close to it. That's the amazing thing is they did it all without. It's due to George Martin and their brilliance together. Yeah.
And playing in Hamburg for as long as they did, for as rough of a schedule as they had.
Right.
So tell me about the beginnings of Pentagram. What year did that start? What were your biggest influences?
There's kind of a dispute on the starting point, but
okay.
let's call it around 70-71 era.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Just to be
not getting into the Stone Bunny confusion crap.
Yeah, without getting specific, because I mean we went through all these name changes in the beginning.
Yeah, the first single you were labeled as Massacre, even when you re-released it on First Days here.
Oh, Macabre.
Or Macabre, sorry.
Yeah, well, Macabre was the first demo single, and it was misprinted, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? That's such a Spinal Tap moment.
And we had to, we had it repressed, and but that was, just demo stuff, and all the stuff on First Days here was never released. It was just demos.
Was that stuff recorded during this early period and later?
It was recorded from 72 to 76 era.
Okay.
I mean, the band wasn't ever formally signed until 1985.
Nice.
Yeah. And we had already been together almost, like 15 years.
Oh, that's awesome. So you guys had already kind of cut your teeth and knew where you wanted to go by the time you reached the demo phase.
Well, yeah, I mean, the early stuff, we didn't get to play anywhere because back then they only wanted cover bands and clubs.
That's what Gene Simmons said when they started Kiss, too.
Yeah, well, they wanted all covers, and we didn't do covers and weren't going to, so we ended up practicing 3 times a week for 3 or 4 hours each time in a junk mailing, Peace Corps junk mail warehouse that my drummer,
awesome.
Jeff O'Keefe's father, was in charge of the warehouse. So we were able to store our equipment there and practice anytime we want and lock ourselves in. And, we just practiced on and on and on. The first 3 years were nothing but rehearsals. I don't think we played any place, or maybe, one or two.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so, we started having, 3 or 4 people come down at the beginning, and then at the end, it was 30, 40, 50, 100.
Then you were starting to get somewhere.
Yeah, I guess. In a manner of speaking, sure.
Doing things in a more unconventional way for the times, but you still persevered on your own terms.
Yeah, I mean, we were intent on keeping it the way we wanted to do it. So,
did you have several lineup changes?
They didn't play anywhere regularly whatsoever, really, until around 1976 or so.
That's when you first started playing gigs?
We played sparsely,
gotcha.
In the early time, but in 76, which is the year the original band broke up.
Do you mind going into why you guys broke up, or was it just something that just happened?
It was musical differences and management problems and so forth.
Ah. What kind of musical differences, if you don't mind me asking?
Management wanted us to do more commercial stuff, and I was really not into that.
Gotcha.
And so, I parted with the other guys and so forth.
Well, I don't blame you. You don't want to sell out.
But, that's something else. Just a musical preference, really.
Yeah, okay.
Not a fault or a minus or a plus,
No malicious intent, no... I mean, those guys were fantastic. Even if you listen to that early stuff on the early days here, you can tell that there was something about that lineup, too.
Oh, yeah.
Just like any other lineup you've had, it's always had its own distinct specialty to it. I wanted to talk to you about Star Lady. And I want to start it out by asking you about a rumor that I've heard and to know whether it's true or not. The rumor I heard, and I've heard this years ago, so I can't quote where it came from.
Yes, yes, because you were interested in Star Lady and also Hurricane.
How did that come about? I've heard that you told Paul Stanley to fuck off.
No, Kiss came to sort of audition us in the real early days, like in 76.
So right as they were taking off as well, they weren't quite.
Yeah. They were getting really pretty big already, so they
yeah, because they were recording Destroyer.
Yeah.
And Rock and Roll Over, so they had already done Alive.
Yeah, and our manager, one of the two managers at the time, had written the first national review of their first album when it came out, and so he had an inroad to get with them. Because he had, an unusual circumstance there. And we met them and so forth and so on. And then they came over to the house. We practiced that in Dale, Virginia. They came over in a limo.
Wow.
And it was Gene and Paul. And they,
were they in makeup?
No, of course not. No, but they came and listened to us for hers. And they didn't like it. They said that me and the bass player have bad skin, the drummer's too fat, and the guitar player is just no personality at all. And
wow.
They liked the music, apparently. It seemed that way,
Why would it matter what you look like? Never mind, it's Kiss. I love Kiss to death, but they've always been more so, I think, about the image than the actual content of the music.
Oh, no, it's both the better, though. And,
yeah, I agree, but at the same time.
I'm listening to us in a practice, not on that one.
Yeah,
good, so
that seems kind of harsh.
But, it is what it is, so forth, so.
I mean, I can see why they'd be interested in Star Lady and Hurricane. They're fantastic songs. Obviously, you know how I feel about Star Lady. What was the inspiration for Star Lady itself, and how was it written?
Well, Star Lady was written by myself and my dear buddy, one of my closest friends ever, actually, Randy Palmer, who was in the band. He died almost 20 years ago now in a car accident, but Randy and I were sitting at a friend's house one night, and we decided, let's write a song together, and we both had a very equal share in Star Lady. In fact, it's the only song I'd say that I've ever co-written with someone where he had the original idea, gave it to me, I inserted something, and it went back and forth, and very, very 50-50, even on the lyrics.
Wow.
Which is pretty unusual, because when there's a Pentagram co-write on an album, generally speaking, I will have written the lyrics, and maybe a little of the music, but predominantly lyrics, and the other person usually will have written the music. When you see two names on it. Now, Jeff O'Keefe and I, the original drummer, we did some real, real close co-written stuff that I'm really, really still proud of. We did Wheel of Fortune and Suffering, which is the band finally did on Curious Volume, the last studio album, and we did a last decade. So went up and back, but nothing is like Star Lady. Star Lady was really strange in a way. It was like one line you, one line me, one line you, one line me, and very, very even Steven down the line between Randy and I.
That's amazing. That song just has such a simple vibe, but it just, I don't know what it is. That song just grabs me. Is that going to be on the set list for the tour?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact.
Oh, sweet. I'll be there on the 29th, so I can't wait to hear it.
Cool.
My first ever Doom show is with the band that started it all, so.
I hope you like it. I wish nowadays that we played a lot louder live than we've been doing. know, a few years ago, we were really killing it on the volume, and it's, the volume doesn't make good, but when it's good and you're into it, the volume only increases the intensity.
It, so, it makes you go from, like, to, rah, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I was talking to my bass player, Greg, about that, about, hey, we need to get more amps again on stage, you know?
Yeah.
I like it when it's slobbering loud.
Oh, yeah. Everyone does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started playing heavy, killer heavy music because of Blue Cheer.
Yeah.
You know, Reputation always the loudest band ever.
Oh, yeah, they were. They're definitely overlooked in the history of metal.
Yeah.
And hard rock and everything else in general. I mean, you could pick up influences of grunge from their stuff, for God's sakes. That didn't happen until 30 or 40 years after they were already broke up.
Right, right, yeah. Cheer or something else. They were wild, loud, and awful heavy, and gloomy at times.
They were kind of like the heavier version of the Stooges at the time. Really just, they kind of remind me of like a heavier, more metallic version of the Stooges at that time, because the Stooges were on the other spectrum of that, just making simplistic, guttural music, and these guys were doing the same, but with a bit of a harder punch. More bassy tones, more heavy tones. It's what I hate.
Well, kind of, they both sort of have a fuck you attitude.
Oh, yeah. The attitude is always important, and it's definitely a fuck you attitude. We're going to do what we want, whether you like it or not.
Right.
And that's rock and roll.
At its heart. Yeah, it sort of is. I mean, people seem to want the music shoved up their ass and down their throat at the same time.
Yeah. If and it's not like a problem if you like it, and if you don't like it, the rest of them are like fucking laughing at you because you're mortified, and they're just like, ah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's if you don't like that kind of music, I can see where it's real obnoxious to people because it's so overbearing. It's domineering stuff. So.
It's extreme music for extreme people.
I guess so. Yeah.
I mean,
speaking it is, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's how they describe extreme metal, but that can go for heavy metal in general, because, I mean, it is intense. No matter if it's old school or modern, it's still going to be intense. Some people can't handle that. They want, I love you, baby, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I can see where people want candy coating, but I just like it pretty raw. Although, like, you know, I don't like all the tagging now and all the metalist metal.
Yeah, you don't like doom metal, do you?
Yeah, I don't like doom metal. I don't like speed metal, thrash metal, doom metal, black metal, whatever. You know, even what they call heavy metal now. So, you know, Peter and play heavy hard rock. That's
yeah. I still consider Judas Priest and Iron Maiden heavy metal. I still consider Judas Priest and Iron Maiden heavy metal, but some even don't consider that heavy metal. They say, you listen to dad rock. I'm like, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they call the music that I play now somewhat, they call it classic rock a lot of times. But
it can't be classic rock because you're not mainstream.
It's classic rock. When you go back to when the classics happened that are rocking, they were heavy metal at the time.
Blue Oyster Cult, so they're supposed to be the American Black Sabbath, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're one of the early ones.
Oh, yeah. Way. I mean, even Wino on a documentary has said, like, Bobby is a god. He started it all. You know?
Yeah, Wino's a good buddy of mine.
Yeah, my buddy from the band Saints and Winos is a good friend of
his. I've been Wino 4 years now.
Oh, wow, you lucky son. I haven't gotten to Wino yet.
Yeah, well, we started playing with Obsessed when the band was called Death Row.
They were called Death Row.
What's that?
They were called Death Row at one point?
No, we were.
Oh, I know you guys were. I thought you said the Obsessed were. I was throwing away for a second.
No, the Obsessed and Death Row and Asylum, which became Unorthodox, and Hellion, another band, they're friends of mine.
Nice.
We used to play, the four of us, a lot together.
And that kind of started what became the scene.
Yeah, in DC, a lot, yeah, the what was later labeled as the Doomy stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the Downer Rock stuff, you know, but, yeah, we started playing just in 81.
Nice. My buddy from the band Saints and Winos has played with, I believe, you guys, and has played with Wino a few times. Joe Delacqua.
We just played with Obsessed, as a matter of fact, on Labor Day weekend, the place Muddy Roots Festival in Tennessee.
Nice. You've got Spiral Grave open up some shows with you recently, too. I'm good friends with them as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many jillion bands out there now. God, I don't remember all the bands we play with. And plus, I don't get to listen to anybody that we play with at smaller shows, like club shows and stuff like that, and small venue shows.
Because you're getting ready and everything, right?
Right, we're getting ready to go on, and, you know, we're just all back in the dressing room or whatever, green room, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, we're out on a bus or something like that, you know.
Oh, gotcha.
You come in an hour before you play, and, you know, you're changing the radio on, so, you know, you really don't hear anyone else, per se.
Yeah.
Unless it's in a festival, you know. When we play
that makes sense.
Yeah, we play the festival.
Everything's kind of set up ahead of time, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, when we played that, like, for instance, Obsessed went on at 5 in the afternoon on one stage. It was like four stages for one thing.
Gotcha.
You know, they went on 5 in the afternoon. We went on at midnight. You know? So.
Understood. That's really cool.
Yeah, I wish we could play the next night instead, because, you know, the festival is 4 days. But the next night was Wayne Kramer.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we were going to get to that.
Yes. And, he's the one person in my entire life that I would give anything to sit down and get it with, because Wayne is one of my all-time idols.
Oh, yeah. I have his signed book, The Hard Stuff, and I've just started it, and I'm not going to give away anything.
It's incredible. I listened to it on Audible because I want it, because it's narrated by him.
Gotcha.
Okay. And I am absolutely just even fascinated listening to his voice, like on his first 5 solo albums, he does spoken word stuff. And it's like kind of...
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah, it's really neat. It's like got that beatniky.
Oh, nice. I'll have to check that out. That's right up my alley.
He's really remarkable. I think he's the best lyricist I have ever hands down heard. Brilliant.
I'm only familiar with his MC5 stuff, so I'll have to definitely check out his solo stuff now. You've got me.
Yeah, his solo stuff is just, wow, it just blows me. I mean, Wayne has done, you know, over 100 different albums.
I know.
How many people. But his first 5 solo albums are just earthly good. My God.
I will definitely check them out. One thing I want to touch on is, who are your biggest influences that made you do what you do now? Because I know they're not what people would stereotypically think.
Right. Most people haven't heard of a lot of them. Well, now some of them in the underground venue, it's a genre, I should say.
Yeah.
It's come to be more prominent, that more people have delved into and now heard, but back then, nobody had heard of the bands that I listened to, which were a lot of Stray from England, Groundhogs, Sir Lord Baltimore
is so underrated.
Oh, yeah, well, they're so unknown, too.
Yeah.
You know, Highway Robbery, Stray Dog, not Stray. Let's see, Rocky Erickson.
I love Rocky.
Yeah, Rocky was great. Let's see. The Frost, all the Dick Wagner things related to Dick Wagner.
How stupid.
in his early days. Nobody, excuse me, nobody really gave notice to Dick when he was doing the Alice Cooper stuff.
Oh, I know.
Because, you know, he was a backup musician
For Alice, the most basically. Part,
in The Frost and Ursa Major after that. Yeah, those are his bands, and they're just unreal. A lot of the Detroit bands, man. I mean, SRC, the Amboy Dukes, early Ted, you know.
Yeah, before he became douchey.
you know, of course, Stooges, MC5, Up, Jagged Edge, Bob Seger System, early Bob Seger System,
yeah.
Incredible. Just fucking remarkable.
Completely different than the Silver Bullet Band.
What's that? You're breaking up.
I said it was completely different than the Silver Bullet Band for the younger listeners who don't know.
Yeah. That's another side of the coin, totally.
I completely
There were a lot of bands from Texas that I listened to that didn't get known at all. Bubble Puppy, who became Damien, the same four people. They each had one album.
Nice.
Bubble Puppy actually had three albums, but only one that was really ever heard about. Actually, even had a radio hit back in the 60s. But early Elevators again. Early ZZ Top.
Oh, yeah.
I still love anything by ZZ Top, but the early stuff, man, the first three or four albums kicked ass. Jesus Christ.
That's always a band's, like, general best output, it seems, because it seems like the first three or four albums, they had a lot of time to write a lot of the material, whereas later on, it's more like, oh shit, we've got 6 months to write 12 songs.
Yeah, sort of like that, yeah, it seemed more like that. Oh, early Love, All the Mountain stuff ever.
Oh yeah.
And Leslie West is still fucking going, thank God, and he's remarkable to this day.
Yeah, he's another blip under the radar that most people should know more about.
Yeah, nowadays they should, yeah.
Royster Hall.
Mountain were very huge, big in time, but I mean, Grand Funk, people don't Grand Funk anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Shit, Grand Funk were an institution, for God's sake. They probably had 20 plus top 10 hits.
Yeah.
And they still were one of the heaviest, raw, goddamn live. There's no words for Grand Funk Live. They were so loud and bombastically wild and heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez. And I don't know who else. I can go on and on, you know. I like early Jethro Tull, even. I like early, I love New York Dolls. I love
the Dolls as well, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Johnny Thunder fanatic.
My writer's name, Andy Thunders, is an homage to Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't trying to steal anybody's name. I'm just trying to pay homage to an underrated great who influenced me greatly. His solo stuff is so heart-wrenching, too.
Yep, definitely. Hard luck story, too.
Did you see the movie they did, Room 237, that investigates sort of the death of Johnny Thunders? It's kind of like a horror movie about how he died.
Yeah, you mean where they interviewed the people and they went to the place in New Orleans?
No, this is actually a movie based on what happened, based on the accounts.
That's right.
Because they don't know exactly what happened to him.
They're not really sure. You know, some say OD, some say killed, poisoned, you know, whatever.
The movie points more towards the poisoning part for a robbery.
Well, people who make a movie that's in itself generally a tribute to the person they're doing it about, and therefore it can be a little bit slant and not want people to see just how bad Johnny was.
Well, Johnny was bad. We all know this. There's clips, the In Cold Blood concert, where his eyes are rolling in the back of his head, but at the same time, the guy is so hopped up on junk, but he's still performing better than half people alive today could even do sober. Like, he's so fucked up, but he's still up there giving it his all. That's the thing that I admired about him. as fucked up as he was, he would still get the job done to the best of his ability.
Well, the showbiz part, unfortunately, in heavy rock is gone.
Yeah, I know.
And that sucks to me, people. I can't stand it when I go see a band and they have on the backwards baseball hat, a football jersey, cutoffs, and sneakers.
And the flat brim cap with the tribal tattoos.
All of that shit is like, look, I'm standing next to the same fucking guy in the goddamn Safeway who wants to go pay to see him on stage.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no glamour, and I don't mean glam rock, I mean just glamour itself to the showbiz aspect of being in a rock band anymore, and it used to mean something. I used to know when you saw someone even on the street.
You'd know they were a rocker.
Yeah, exactly. You say, man, that guy must be in a band. And it was a different individual looking, you know, situation.
Yeah.
Now it's, everybody's going up there, you know, dirtball. It's just bullshit to me.
I mean, even the grunge guys put on the torn jeans and shit and at least looked like a rocker to some degree.
Yeah.
You know?
That to me is, we differ. Your opinion differs from mine on that. Because I think that's where, and that's totally the epitome of what started to change and made it, in quotes, cool to be a slob.
Yeah, you have a point there. You have
and,
a valid point.
You know, if you're wearing just a pair of jeans on stage, I mean, it's just, to me, it's not the signification of being in a show band.
Well, I think the whole show thing
is. You want to see a show. If I just wanted to hear the fucking music and you're just going to slop out,
I'd stay home. I mean, I get that, but I think the whole grunge response and the whole dressing down was a response to all the schlock 80s hair bands that looked pretty and couldn't play worth a dick.
Yeah, it's because those bands, in my opinion, it's because a lot of those bands played like dog shit, but they looked cool as hell.
Some could say that's what the New York Dolls did, but they had an edge, they had a bite.
Oh,
well,
the Dolls couldn't play, though. The Dolls stank real good. They sucked real good.
Exactly, but they had a bite. They had an edge. I mean, bands like White Lion were poppy as fuck.
Yeah. You know, the Dolls, Pink Fairies, early things like that were really
Harlots of 42nd Street. Stuff like that.
What's that?
The Harlots of 42nd Street.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that whole early Max.
Wayne County.
Yeah.
All those bands were, they gave you something that was a spectacle to look at. You know, the early Kiss stuff was the same era, virtually. You know,
yeah,
so.
They were part of the same scene in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul Stanley talked about playing a Rent Party with the Bratz back in the day, and everybody was like, who the fuck are they? But then they got up and played, and they all wanted to be their fucking friends.
Right.
They were all, like, acting like they were cooler than them until they could play better than all of them.
The Dickies, still get out on tour. That's really cool, you know. Yeah, those guys are really nice people, and these people are the groups that really started the scene, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of, you know, the glam, rock and roll, really, the thing.
Yeah, that even filtered over into England. They influenced Bowie and T-Rex and all of them.
Right.
So, when did Pentagram officially get signed to a label, and what was it like recording your first album and going on tour for that album?
Well, we didn't get signed until 1985, but the original first album was recorded as as a demo, virtually. Excuse me. And it was in 1982 when we were called Death Row. And it was put out, there were 250 copies of a cassette made by Death Row called All Your Sins.
Nice.
And that was put out, and then in 85, the band got signed officially, and...
What label was that?
Dutch East India.
Okay.
It was to Pentagram Records at the time. I'm not even going to go into the stories too long with the situation with us speaking on Pentagram Records. to put it very shortly, in short, the label existed. I called the label and said, no, you can't do that because it's the same.
You can't have a label with the same name as your band.
Yeah, because we're both doing the same thing, and I have a trademark on the name, blah, blah. So they signed us, and I guess the rest is history, you know. So the first album came out in 85, and then Bear Reckoning came out in 87, I believe it was. And
how was the reception to them at the time?
What's that?
What was the reception to them at the time?
Well, the people who heard it, it was excellent. But, no, there wasn't virtually any promotion.
Yeah, the scene hadn't gotten to where it is now either.
Well, the original releases of them, you know, didn't get promoted. And then it was in around 91 that I got contacted by a little tiny independent label called Peaceville in England. And they said, we want to re-release your stuff. And they're a tiny company. I mean, three or four people working at it. And one of the guys who ran it flew over from England. And I went up to New York and met with him for a weekend. And we negotiated some stuff, and then they signed Pentagram, and the albums were re-released it would be the third time, if you call it Death Row, and then the first Pentagram.
Yeah.
Twice, they were re-released, and the first one was called Relentless. It was named after that. It was self-titled originally.
Yeah.
So Peaceful got us, you know, really a lot of promotion and kind of started putting things a little bit on the map. And I guess it was, what, 91, 92. And then in 93, we recorded the third album, also for Peaceful, Be Forewarned.
And then a classic, obviously, that comes back from your early days.
What's that?
That song's existed in many versions itself.
Yes, it did. Yes, and as a matter of fact, we just recently recorded a brand new studio version of it, exactly like the original single arrangement, except it's got some more bells and whistles added.
I was going to say, the guitars are probably heavier and more distorted than the original. You know, it's not
much distortion, it's just the overall sound has got technology, you know.
Oh, so I like the sound of that, because that's actually my favorite version.
I'll have to hear
the new version.
You know, we've got to add a couple of acoustic guitars at the beginning and, you know, stuff like that.
Basically, it's kind of going back and taking the demo version and making it what it should have been for an album, in a way.
Hopefully. we'll be letting people hear it real soon.
Let me know when that's out immediately.
Well, there's an interview that I'm doing also with a radio station. I can't even remember the name of it called, but it's right now, but I'm not going to say it anyway. But they've been sent a copy of the brand new Be Forewarned.
Oh, cool.
And they go out to about 16 different stations also, and they also are broadcast in Germany.
That's awesome. It's about time you finally get your just due.
Yeah. It's a good song.
So what is your least favorite Pentagram album, and what is your most favorite?
Wow. My least favorite. Actually, I guess my least favorite would be Bay Reckoning.
Is there a why?
A why? Well, for one, it's too short.
Okay.
For two, I can't stand the pressing. The sound of the pressing overall, to me, doesn't have the the full body bass guitar and the heaviness. I know everybody loves the first Pentagram album, you know, who are Pentagram fans, but I don't like the first two albums because I would have to say they're too Sabbath-y.
Gotcha.
In a lot of ways. And I also...
They kind of painted you in a corner as a Sabbath doomy band when...
Yeah, and just... Now, this is just personally...
Yeah.
The songs... The way the songs are put across, it leans towards that, and I sang... you know, we used to joke around and say, you know, it's Bobby Osborne.
You sounded more like a Gene Simmons to me on the Relentless version of the album to me. You had some Gene Simmons moments.
See, I hear Ozzy all over the first two, and even into a bit of the V for Warned album, but not near as much. And
yeah.
I just don't, you know, I like the more, the later individual sounding stuff. It's more original with Anthel.
What's your favorite Pentagram?
This is out of our regular, if you want to call them, releases. I mean,
yeah, not your compilations and live albums and all that.
Right, because there's some off-the-wall stuff, you know, that people hardly even know about. I mean, you know, there's 2012, Live Rights, double album, Live in Helsinki.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, nobody got that because there were 1,000 of them put out. That's that.
Yeah. What's your favorite Pentagram release and why?
My favorite by far is Sub-Basement. Sub-Basement, that's my absolute baby because it was a fluke and came out so depraved and so depressing, but so freaking wild and heavy. And I'm proud of all the stuff, absolutely every song on it, all the mixing, all the production. We just happened to hit the nail with that. And
it took you 50 years, but you got it.
It took a long damn time, that's for sure. But Sub-Basement's my favorite, definitely. And besides Sub-Basement, next to Sub-Basement, I like Review Choices and Show 'Em How. And those three albums, especially Sub-Basement and then Show 'Em How, were grossly overlooked when it was released because it came out at the same exact time within a month of First Days Here.
Ah, gotcha. And, of course, everyone, including me, flocked for that one.
Right.
I didn't even see anything about Sub-Basement, so the promotion must not have been that good.
No, the promotion was excellent, as a matter of fact, and especially all over Europe, and I mean, I have just slews of magazine articles about Sub-Basement and the reviews and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool.
But, it just got, you know, overshadowed, unfortunately, and that's the album I really adore, though.
They couldn't wait a little bit to release Sub-Basement. To give a gap in between, if they would have gave a gap in between releases, it might have been fared better at the time.
Well, yeah, but they're on two different labels. So
true. So you can't really do anything about that.
Right. In fact, Sub-Basement, originally its release date projected, the date it was supposed to be released worldwide was 9/11.
Wow.
And it got pushed back.
That's also my wife's birthday, too, ironically. So, like,
really?
Her birthday's overshadowed by that, too.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, it got pushed back, I think, it was a week or a month because of 9/11. So.
That's really odd how a lot of stuff that really may not have had anything at all in common with what happened was pushed back. I mean, I completely understand the sentiment, but... It's still weird to me how a rock record had to be pushed back because of the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers. Maybe it's because of everything going on and the security went right up to max.
It was more in tribute type of situation because it was not, it wasn't released in the United States originally at all.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, what are your plans for the 50 years anniversary of Pentagram, and okay. What else are you up to?
For the upcoming year, I'll say, which, 4950, whatever,
yeah.
it's in the work right now for us to do a whole lot of big European festivals again, like we were doing in the mid-teens, 2000s, all over Europe, Scandinavia. We're going in late spring to Japan, which we've never played. We're trying to look that up right now with Australia and New Zealand. And let's see, South America.
Nice.
We're negotiating with some things going on in Brazil right now, and hopefully Mexico. And then, besides all those, I really can't say if I'm there. I mean, there's a lot. Hopefully, it will be pretty heavy on the scheduling of, you know, touring.
Are you doing any other musical projects?
I personally am, yes. I'm currently in the work for an album that's supposed to be recorded this coming January with Sonny Vincent, who's a legend in the punk rock world. Sonny and I are working on doing an album together now that we're entirely co-writing. I'm writing all the lyrics and Sonny's writing the music.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so we're supposed to record that in January for release, you know, hopefully early spring.
Definitely send me an EPK of that when that starts to come out. I want to review that immediately.
Cool, yeah, and I'm also working on a couple other projects that I won't go into now because they're just in their infancy.
Gotcha.
But there's a band in the Midwest that I'm supposed to sing on their album, and hopefully if I can get to it, I'm going to do a couple of cuts with Bampua.
Yeah, cool.
Jim Gustafson's band from the early, early 70s. In fact, they were doing albums way before Pentagram.
Yeah.
And those things are going on. And let's see what else. Oh, we're going to try like hell, because I'm intending doing this, to do a live Pentagram album on location that we're going to start recording things from gigs soon for, and that will kind of be it might not be interesting to some people who've listened to us for a long time, have heard this and that live stuff by Pentagram, but we've never really done an album of all the in quote classic Pentagram songs.
That is true. You haven't done a live album with Star Lady on it, really, and stuff like that.
And
the fact that you're recording on location of the different tour stops, that's definitely cool as well. That's a treat for people who see the tour, really.
Right, right. So we're hopefully going to get that done starting in the near future and kind of put that together to release sometime next year, you know.
That would be cool as hell. Hopefully a song or two ends up from the show I'm at.
That soon, but,
oh, that's okay. That'll make it special for all of us there. You know.
But nevertheless, you know, we have to, since the Pentagram list is going to probably stay almost the same through the next year, you know, the stage set, even though we're personally, the songs might get old to us in the band. There's a lot of people out there who still have never heard us or never heard of us. just getting turned on to it, and songs like Sign of the Wolf and Fear My Queen, When the Screams Come, and, you know, Forewarned and so forth, 21 and,
yeah.
You know, they're mainstays, and we play them every single night, so we're gonna, you know, on that one, they'll be on that order.
Even Ozzy plays Paranoid in his solo band.
Right.
And has since day one.
Some of them you gotta play.
Yeah. It's just as simple as
that. Every night, you know, you're not with the same crowd.
Yeah, but you're with the same material, so you might be like, ugh, but I'm sure the energy from the crowd makes it.
It does.
It evens definitely. It out for you, I'm sure.
Definitely does, yeah. The crowd makes it. You know, without them, there isn't any us.
Oh, yeah. So, in conclusion, is there anything you'd like to say to your fans?
Yes. I want to thank all the fans for the degenerational listening that they've done and for the longevity that they've given us. And hopefully we'll keep it going for a while. So a direct quote is, you keep listening, we'll keep bringing it.
Nice.
Okay. And
the last thing I want to ask is, what do you love about music, and what inspires you to write a song?
Wow.
Heavy stuff, isn't it?
I don't know. What do I like about music?
What do you love about music?
What do I love about music? It makes me... it gives me an emotional uprising, upheaval, and upfeeling in all ways. It makes me feel good. You know, that's really the only thing I can do with that. I mean, I love music because it's my passion.
Yeah.
And the other part is what?
What inspires you to write a song? Like, do you have to be inspired to write certain songs?
No. It just happens.
It just comes to you?
Yeah, I can't put a finger on anything like that. I mean, like, the stuff coming up, it's not Pentagram. I'm obligated to do stuff, and I never really had that much in that way that's been a must, you know, but the inspiration just comes from all things in my life, you know. So.
That's awesome. But all right, Bobby, this has been wonderful. I enjoyed this very much. I hope you did as well.
Yes, I very much did, and I want to thank you again.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Do it. So very, very lots from Pentagram and myself especially.
It will be an honor to finally be able to see you in concert on the 29th and be able to meet you and shake your hand after.
Okay, cool. Sounds good to me.
All right, man. Well, you take care, and I'll be looking forward to seeing you bring it.
Okay, sounds good. Now you can turn off the recorder. Or whatever. And whatever's going on. And
I'll have to call you back for that, if that's okay.
Okay.
All right.
Yes. Okay,
take it easy,
take care,
man.
And get the thing out when you can. And
of course, this will be a lot easier.
Okay, good.
All right, peace and love,
sounds
man.
Sounds good, buddy. All right, you too. Bye.